Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. Nice to have you with us today. I'm on the road. I'm on a regular telephone, not in studio, so I apologize for the lack of technical perfection that the show normally has. But hopefully you'll be able to hear me. Now, today we're going to talk about the latest in health and healing. We have a lot to share on that issue, not the least of which is better understanding our mitochondria. Mito, M-I-T-O, chondria, C-H-O-N-D-R-I-A. It can actually trigger cellular aging from Newcastle University in the United Kingdom. Then we're going to look at meditation. What it does something really wonderful. It can ease pain, anxiety, and fatigue during breast cancer, and we'll look at that from Duke University. Also today, the rhino, the tiger, and the snow leopard, they all have something in common. Their DNA was found in Chinese medicine. That's not good. And therefore, if we're going to receive Chinese medicine, make sure you know exactly what's in it so that you can say no to anything that endangers those wonderful sentient species. That's from the University of Adelaide in Australia. Also today, nutrient deprivation kills kidney cancer cells. That's a good thing. So how do we do it? Duke University and tells us how. Toxic lead. Well, we can get out of the body, right? You live in Flint, you got a lot of lead in there, but a week or two by not drinking it, you're okay. No. No, unfortunately, toxic lead stays in your body for years after exposure. Who says so? Georgia State University researchers. Also today, we'll look at spicy food for a longer life. Which kind of spices? How much longer could we expect to live? And also, research examines how loneliness, we've got an epidemic of that in our society, affects the social human brain, University of Chicago. So we have an awful lot to focus on today. Plus, time permitting, I also want to look at the toxic threat is killing off Europe's killer whales and dolphins. A new study finds genetically engineered alfalfa has gone wild, exposing the failure of this coexistence philosophy. They don't coexist. And the deep ocean warming is happening at an alarming and increasingly rapid rate. So says a group of scientists. What does that mean? Nothing good, but I'll share that with you. And carbon dioxide capture from air converted directly into menthol, and that is good. So I'll talk about that from the University of Southern California. And time permitting today, I also want to explore some issues. One, the historical issue of DDT. DDT is, without question, one of the most toxic chemicals ever created, and we exposed a lot of people to it, not the least of which was a whole country, North Vietnamese and South Vietnamese, today are living the legacy, a deadly legacy of our defoliant being used there. Also, I've recently been down the Louisiana coastline, and I've asked the people there, do you feel safe if there's another Category 3, 4, or 5 hurricane like Katrina? The answer is no. And why? Well, because you have the Louisiana coastline is disappearing. It's gone. How'd that happen? We'll have an audio clip on that. We'll have an audio clip of Rachel Carson inside the Silent Spring. That's very rare. And then Dr. Deidre Little, Truth and Gardasil. In the beginning of 2013, the Australian government began to roll out the Gardasil vaccine program for all boys ages 13 to 15, and a regular Orthodox doctor who was pro-vaccine took a look at the evidence, looked at the science, and became very concerned, as all doctors would be if they did that homework. So we will, time permitting, play that clip. Let's begin. We know that our cells need energy. Every cell in your body needs to have energy. And where that energy comes from is what is called the mitochondria. And an international team of scientists has, for the first time, shown that mitochondria, the batteries of the cell, are essential for aging. Well, that's just common sense. You don't have to be a scientist to figure this out. How many times have you found someone who is older generally slows down? They don't seem to think as quickly. They don't move with the same agility. Everything is in slower motion. It doesn't have to be, by the way. The fact that it is means that we have this kind of herd-like mindset and acceptance that aging the way we do with all the diseases is an inevitable part of life. It is not. I once went home to West Virginia. I had just published my first best-selling book, The Complete Handbook of Nutrition. And as would always happen on a Sunday, all my in-laws would gather. My Uncle George, he was the kind of the patriarch of the whole family. He was an engineer. I thought he was terrific. I really liked him. His hobby was collecting Indian arrowheads out of the Blanahatchet Island. He had thousands of them. And he was just one cool guy. In any case, here they would play canasta, all the adults in one room and us kids in the other room, in the kitchen, and they give us a quarter and we go to a movie. When I was a kid, that's what I remember. These were wonderful times. And then here I come back. I'm a young guy in my early 20s. I give them all a copy of my book, and they're all looking at, well, that's very good, Gary. We're very proud of you. I said, well, I didn't give it to you to be proud of me or to put it on a bookshelf. I'd like you to actually read it. And more importantly, I'd like for you to look at if you could change anything. And they kind of laughed. Then they all laughed. And then the whole room was just bursting with laughter as they were all smoking and drinking and laughing. And I was the only one not laughing, and I couldn't figure out why they were laughing. And then my Aunt Helen said, well, Gary, you know, we're happy with our lives. We're happy people. And yeah, we're not going to be, you know, looking like those people up there in New York City that you're used to, but down here in Parkersburg, we're fine. So there's two realities, she said. There's your reality up there, and there's our reality down here. But what do you think we're going to give up? We're going to give up our roast beef, our mashed potatoes and gravy, our muffins, our Jell-O, our pumpkin pie. Which one of these are we going to get? Our coffee with sugar? No. Our cigarettes, we enjoy these. You know, and at least she was completely honest, and I really cared for this woman. She had a phenomenal sense of humor. She was my father's sister, and she lived with my Uncle George since her husband had died for like 40 years, and she was always morbidly overweight, and she smoked and drank, and she had diabetes and high blood pressure, but they all did. Now, here was the issue. When I would say, well, you know, you can overcome that diabetes, you can overcome that pain. No, you can't. Yeah, you can. You can. I'm helping people do that. Well, yeah, and they wouldn't believe me because they had bought into that kind of fatalistic notion that, well, it's meant to be. What's meant to be? What in the world is meant to be? It was so frustrating. You have no idea, because I'd be driving back on a Greyhound bus to New York on that 27-hour drive, and they allowed smoking back then. There'd always be someone with those putrefying cigars smoking. And I would think to myself, wow, that didn't go so well. I didn't help anybody. And I remember going back every 3 or 4 months, and not one person ever opened my book and read a single word from it. But they're all proud of me, you know. And when I'd appear on Johnny Carson or Mike Douglas or Merv Griffin, that, oh, we saw you on television. Everybody's talking in town about Gary appeared on television. And that was a big deal. And when I go home, my buddies would chide me about it. But they'd sit there talking about, Gary, what's good for smoking? Are you going to stop? No. I just want to know what's good for it. It wouldn't matter what I did. I was never able to help a single human being growing up that was my family or friends. They just wouldn't change. So when we know today that those of us who are willing to change whatever needs to change, we got to change the idea that somehow we should all grow old the same way. Just keep this in mind. You are not your chronological age. You're either younger than it, or the 40 is the new 70 if you really take care of yourself, meaning if you're on a plant-based vegan diet and you're juicing and you're exercising and you're getting the right supplements, then your biochemistry is about 35 to 40 years old. If you're 60, you can be the new 30 if you do the same thing. But if you are 60 and you've been drinking and eating the typical American diet and not properly supplementing and not dealing with stress, right, not exercising as you should, then you're about 100 to 110. And that's why, on the one hand, we know that the cells in our body, if properly nourished, could live to be about 130, that we're not even living, in many cases, half that. That's the reason. But at the heart of all this is the mitochondria. So here's the deal. And this was published in the EMBO journal. And there was at Newcastle University, they found out that the mitochondria were eliminated from aging cells. They became much more similar to younger cells. And this experiment was able for the first time to conclusively prove that mitochondria are major triggers of cellular aging. Now, this brings scientists a step closer to developing therapies to counteract aging cells by targeting mitochondria. But you have been doing that for a long time. You can help your mitochondria by giving it NADH and coenzyme Q10 and PPQ and R-alpha-lipoic acid and vitamin C and quercetin and DHEA. All of those will help your aging cells become more repaired. Now, when you're taking in your berries, eating them fresh, organic, or juiced berries, or concentrate, or berry powders, and the same with vegetables, then what you're doing, you're going into the cell with these hundreds of different phytonutrients, and especially if you have the good fatty acids, let's say from olive oil and flaxseed oil, hemp oil, coconut oil, and all that working together repairs it. And when you repair that genetically damaged material, then the old cell is young again. And especially if you use L-carnosine and from grapes, which are one of nature's most perfect foods, and grape juice, and resveratrol, grape seed extract and grape skin extract. So those actually are regenerative. So the idea is that we may be one age chronologically, but we can actually de-age our mitochondria through repair. You can't repair your cells if what you're taking in is pro-inflammatory. So that's good news science. Also, from Duke University, they found that meditation eases anxiety, fatigue, and pain for women undergoing breast cancer biopsies. So anyone who has any disease would benefit from meditation. And it doesn't have to be anything fancy. You don't have to go off to an ashram and meditate. Just simply sitting quietly in nature and just being present, where you can hear what's going on around you, if it's birds, if it's the wind, if it's rain. Think how much we relax when recently it was raining and I had a room underneath what was a tin overhang. And there I'm sitting at 2 in the morning and just listening to the rain hit that tin roof, and wow, so relaxing. Sitting at the seashore and overlooking a lake, a river. These are things that can relax us. So you see, that is a living meditation. You don't have to be chanting anything. You don't have to be breathing out of your left nostril. Just be with nature. And that can ease pain, anxiety, and fatigue. that particular study was published in the Journal of American College of Radiology. Also, they're finding that a lot of these Chinese medicines, they used different wild and very important animals, meaning there are so few left that they're nearing extinction, including rhinoceros, the tiger, and the leopard. And so you don't want any of that. And this was published in Forensic Science Medicine Pathology. And a professor fired from the University School of Medicine found that these Chinese traditional medicines, they're using this. And so do your homework. Don't use any Chinese medicine unless you know all of the ingredients. Now, from Duke University comes a really interesting study, and it's based upon killing cancer cells. Now, all cells need nutrients, and all cells feed off sugar, but cancer cells are notoriously power-hungry. As a result, cancer cells must alter their metabolism to provide the additional fuel needed for them to survive and grow and spread, metastasize. And for decades, scientists have been trying to exploit this greedy metabolism as a target for new anti-cancer therapies. Well, Duke University researchers have discovered a promising target for renal, that's your kidney, cell carcinomas. A study appearing in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer Research shows that the majority of these cancers rewire their metabolism in a way that leaves them addicted to an outside nutrient called cysteine. Cysteine. By depriving the cancer cells of the amino acid cysteine, the researchers were able to trigger a form of cell death called necrosis in these particular models. Quote, we found that the same machinery that makes these tumors so aggressive also makes them vulnerable to nutrient deprivation. And it's like we are beating it at its own game. So they put together diets where they made the diet deficient in cysteine, and it was able to help kill the cancer. So for those of you who have cancer and those of you who know someone with cancer and you want to help them, you can read the February 1st, 2016 Cancer Research and get the information on this very important study. Very simple to do. And finally, from Georgia State University, toxic lead stays in the body for years after exposure. So we know what's going on in Flint, and it's not just Flint. It's hundreds of communities have different toxins in their water. But Flint became like the flashpoint for showing us, wow, we have this harmful lead contamination. What we may not realize, however, is that lead exposure is a problem throughout the United States. The CDC estimates that over 4 million households, that's 16 million people, are exposed to elevated lead levels. At least 500,000 children have blood levels of lead above 5 micrograms per deciliter. That's the threshold that prompts a public health response. And lead used to be commonly used in gasoline and household paints and even coloring pigments and artificial turf through the end of the last century. And although today lead is no longer used in these products, there is still plenty of it out there. Lead does not break down in the home or the environment, and the result is that we still have to be concerned about lead poisoning. So what do we do about it? Well, what we can do is we can start to take in more chlorophyllin or chlorophyll, because chlorophyll is one way that binds with the lead and gets it out of our body. Now, if you take vitamin C and, let's say, oh, I'll give you three, wheatgrass, that's a good one. Chlorella is another one, and spirulina is another one. There's three ways of getting lead out. Also, garlic. The more garlic you eat and onions you eat, the more lead you can take out of the body. So easy things to do, not difficult, but it can go a long way to helping your body. By the way, I mentioned spicy foods. There's an interesting study showing that The hottest pepper known, by the way, is the ghost pepper. You don't want to try that. It has a million Scoville heat units. It'll just scorch your mouth, and not even a connoisseur can try that. But just having a little bit of regular jalapeno peppers or chili peppers would make an enormous difference. And in this particular study, they used 487,000 participants from 30 to 79 years of age, and they tracked them for 7 years. And those that ate the most spicy foods and vegetables lived the longest. In fact, they reduced their death rate by 10% if they just did it 1 or 2 days a week. In addition, those who ate spicy foods regularly were less likely to be diagnosed with ischemic heart disease, cancer, and respiratory illness. So, those fresh chili peppers, good for you. Just make sure you get them in on a regular basis. It can make a big difference. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a brief break and come back. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone? I'm Gary Knoll. What we're going to do now is we're going to take a look at an ongoing problem that we have in the United States and around the world, and that is we have been led to believe that something's wrong with us mentally, that we have a diagnosable disorder, and that the only way of helping these disorders is by taking some form of psychotropic drug. I've been playing segments, short segments of a documentary on an ongoing basis to let you know that, first of all, there is no science, real science, to back any of this up. That yes, psychiatry, psychotherapy, psychoanalysis can work and does help people, but not the pharmaceutical approach, but rather the humanistic approach where you sit and have a person have an opportunity to discuss the issues in their life. We all have issues. We all go through ups and downs. We all have losses, and we all mourn at different times. That's not a brain chemical imbalance. That's normal life. So I want you to be able to hear from people. Most of the people you're going to listen to in this clip are psychiatrists. Do you remember last year we had a demonstration? I called together the people in the audience to join me for a demonstration against the American Psychiatric Association outside the Javits Center. We were across the street in a place that the police allowed us to be, and we had a permit. But then I took my camera crew, and we went across to interview psychiatrists. Simple things like, is there any test, any test at all, blood chemistry test, MRI test, any DNA test that can prove that bipolar exists, that schizophrenia exists, that manic exists? And the answer, absolutely every single person said the same thing. No, there's no test. Okay, well, if there's no test to prove that there's a brain chemical imbalance or a way to measure it, then why would you start off with the most toxic possible explanation? And I handed the psychiatrist a list of the different drugs and their known and proven side effects, including suicidality, rage, wanting to hurt other people, hurting themselves. And I said, wouldn't it have been better just to talk with these people first? But in 12 out of 12 cases, a hidden camera shows, and you'll see this in the final film called Manufacturing Madness, that within 2 to 7 minutes of sitting down, they were given a prescription for a psychiatric drug. It's all about the money. It has nothing to do now about helping patients. So let's listen into part three or four of this particular element so you can be better educated, better informed, so you won't become a victim.
Don't report all the other things that are happening.
Case in point, the antidepressant Cymbalta.
Lilly, I believe, in February of 2004, did a clinical trial study. The people in this clinical trial did not have symptoms of depression. And in that clinical trial, there were 11 attempted suicides and 4 suicides completed, one of which was Tracy Johnson, 19-year-old college girl. She did not have any symptoms of depression, and yet this drug pushed her to commit suicide by hanging herself.
That shoots the theory down that they say that, you know, people get suicidal because of the, you know, underlying illness that people kill themselves, that these weren't suicidal people to begin with. These weren't depressed at all. These were healthy people.
A slew of media coverage followed, but psychiatrists on the FDA drug evaluation panel chose to ignore the death and went on to approve Cymbalta the following August.
One of the reasons why we have underestimated the potential of some psychiatric antidepressant drugs to actually trigger a suicidal kind of behavior in people is because the people who designed the research study didn't include in the research questionnaire the suicidal behavior. And then you can report that we had zero incidents of this type of behavior among our subjects.
And then the response is trumpeted as if there's something magical about it, when in fact what's happened is a whole statistical tap dance routine that violates good science. However, on the basis of that kind of phony trial, the drug can be marketed.
Keep in mind that when a drug is tested in the clinical trials, it's only a very short period of time. The final phase of testing can be anywhere from 5 to 6 weeks.
The longest of those studies was 8 weeks. The shortest was 4 weeks. So these are not long-term studies. I think most physicians and most people taking the drugs assume they're long-term, 1 year, 2 years, 3 year studies. They're not. They're very, very short studies.
I find it pretty outrageous that we can base a multi-billion dollar industry on a few 6 or 8 week clinical trials where antidepressant medications beat a sugar pill by a few percentage points.
It is on the basis of biased research such as this that psychotropics with potentially fatal side effects are routinely approved by FDA panels for a lifetime of use. And how can this happen? Because drugs are big money, and FDA panels are dominated by those who benefit by approving them.
The FDA panels that evaluate these drugs are largely psychiatrists. All of a sudden you discover there are 20 different pharmaceutical companies paying them, either grants or honorary or some other way. They're getting paid by the pharmaceutical industry.
If you have a psychiatrist who works at the FDA, he could also be being paid by industry. He might sit on industry panels or discussions or get paid to be a speaker. What I found in working with physicians at the FDA was that they could have dual positions. They could sit on an industry board. They could be influenced by industry.
If you've got 10 FDA scientists or 10 committee members, it's just a matter of 6 saying yes, the drug is safe, 4 saying no. And in almost every single case, those 6 saying that the drug is safe and effective always have pharmaceutical ties. They're getting paid, they're getting funded somehow or another.
Have you been diagnosed with depression and struggle with sadness, trouble sleeping, anxiety, or low energy? Ask your doctor about Effexor XR.
With phase 3 approval a foregone conclusion, the marketing blitz begins. But while psychiatrists have already begun promoting and prescribing these drugs throughout the world, there's one more phase yet to be carried out. Phase 4,
What phase four clinical trials are is when they've actually gotten the drug approved and then they get it into the general population so that we finally find out what it does when it hits ethnic populations, women, children.
Then we see who dies, who has seizures, who has deformed children, who has epilepsy, who has diseases downstream, whose heart stops.
The public is the clinical trial. That's where we find out the problems with these drugs.
This is an experimental stage, and it's so much so that one consumer protection group has advised patients that they refuse a prescription for any drug that hasn't already been on the market for 7 years.
So if you're taking a drug that's only been out for a year or two or three, you are a guinea pig.
And the experimentation doesn't end here. Additional psychiatric drug trials take advantage of the invented disorders in psychiatry's diagnostic and statistical manual to rake in even more profits by targeting the most innocent of all.
If they test their drugs on children, then they get a 6-month extension on their exclusivity period or patent period.
This psychiatric drug research center in Texas uses advertisements to lure in child volunteers. And once inside, they're further enticed with the simplest of tricks.
This is where they're going to be playing. We have Game Boys, we have Xbox, we have 5 TVs.
They come in here and they help themselves to crackers, cookies, free candy, free crackers.
Everything is paid for. You don't pay for anything.
But these perks are just bait to coax children into ingesting powerful psychiatric drugs known to cause suicide and violence in their own age group.
These are drugs that would cost maybe several hundred dollars a month in a pharmacy. They actually are getting them free in research.
We love children, and we just love children because they're our future.
By conducting those tests on children, they get a financial incentive that's worth over $1 billion. Those are the facts. You may call them what you will.
With this kind of money at stake, psychotropic drug experimentation on children is rampant, with 323 studies either completed or in the works, including a 2003 trial that tested children on an antidepressant treating premenstrual dysphoric disorder.
Those drugs which are barely more effective than placebos often have huge side effects which are dangerous and even deadly to people.
Families don't know the risk. If they actually were aware of the risk and believed it, they wouldn't, no one would take that risk.
The psychiatrist would never, she didn't say one word to me about what was going to be the effects of the drugs.
No side effects listed, no, well, let's sit down, we have to talk about this.
At that point in time, he said, well, this doesn't have that type of reaction on any children, you know, that it's very safe.
If he had told me then what I know now about it, I never would have taken it.
She said, oh, Beth must have been on Paxil. That's the only way she would kill herself. And I said, well, what is this? How do people know this?
And that's just some additional insights into the entire madness of the world of psychiatry. Tomorrow I'll be having one of America's leading psychiatrists on the program for a discussion on this very topic. Now from our environmental segment, University of Southern California. Interesting research. Research could one day create a sustainable fuel source from greenhouse gas emissions. They're making fuel from thin air at the University of California Loker Hydrocarbon Research Institute. And for the first time, researchers there have directly converted carbon dioxide from the air into methanol at relatively low temperatures. The work is led by G.K. Prakash and George Ola of the University of California Dornsife College of Letters, Arts and Sciences. It's part of a broader effort to stabilize the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by using renewable energy to transform the greenhouse gas into a combustible cousin attacking global warming from two angles simultaneously. Methanol is a clean-burning fuel for internal combustion engines, a fuel for fuel cells, and a raw material used to produce many petrochemical products. And so that's good news. And that was published in the Journal of the American Chemical Society. I'll keep you up to date on that as it gets closer to being used. Also, I'm concerned about all of these fish and mammals that are dying. European killer whales and bottlenose and striped dolphins suffer from the highest levels of non-banned industrial chemicals ever recorded, according to a study just released today. The contamination has harmed their ability to successfully bear young, and as a result, some European resident whale and dolphin populations have vanished, and others are likely to go extinct, including a pod of killer whales off the coast of the United Kingdom that has dwindled to just 8 individuals and has not produced a calf in the last 26 years. In research published in the journal Scientific Reports, researchers compiled data on concentrations of polychlorinated biphenyls in tissue samples from 1,081 marine mammals, including killer whales and harbor porpoises and striped and bottlenose dolphins. And the samples came from the animals in the United Kingdom, Ireland, Spain, France, and elsewhere. And they found that even though PCBs have been banned in the United Kingdom and European Union since the 1980s, striped and bottlenose dolphins and killer whales carried amounts of the chemicals in their bodies that far surpass the levels known to cause health problems, such as reproductive failures. And while the level of PCBs in marine mammals in the United States has continued to decline since chemicals were banned in the 1980s, contamination remains at normal levels in waters in industrialized areas. So here we have it, one more answer. Flame retardants, electrical equipment, inks, all these chemicals that use PCBs and end up in the environment, well, when it's in the water, it goes into the plankton, it goes into small fish that are eaten by the larger fish, and then one day they become sterile and they can't produce offspring. And when they die out, their whole species dies. That is something we should pay attention to and say, gee whiz, shouldn't we look around to see what we're doing now that could be a problem in the future? From the Center for Food Safety, Bill Fries just published an article on a new study that finds genetically engineered alfalfa has gone wild, exposing failure of the coexistence theory. This is a recent study by USDA scientists shows that genetically engineered alfalfa, in a big way, cannot be controlled. And it's all over the West. This feral GE genetically engineered alfalfa may help explain a number of transgenic contamination episodes over the past few years that have cost American alfalfa growers and exporters millions of dollars in lost revenue, as it also exposes the failure of the USDA's coexistence policy. I remember when they first brought genetically engineered alfalfa and other products to market, and I said, how exactly are you supposed to have a research farm on the river banks, and the first time that floods, that's going to take all those genetically engineered seeds, and it's going to spread them all down the river, and when the water goes down, you're going to have a gazillion of these seeds all over farms and contaminating other things. No, no, no. Well, yes, yes, yes. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture has long maintained that genetically engineered crops can coexist with traditional and organic agriculture. They call this the coexistence narrative. Well, it's just not true. And you have all these transgenes, and they can't be confined. They're growing wild. They're even causing super weeds, weeds that grow fast, taller, thicker, and are hard to deal with. So everything GMO should be banned. And finally, deep water warming is happening at an alarming rate. And this is in the new publication journal Nature Climate Change. Deep underwater, below 700 meters, the ocean holds 35% of the world's heat associated with greenhouse gases. And nearly half of the increases in ocean temperature between 1865 and 1915 occurred in just the last 20 years. So it's getting quicker and quicker and quicker, meaning everything is warming. And as everything warms, that means Antarctica will melt faster, Greenland will melt faster, the glaciers will melt faster. What about all those billions? 2.5 billion people in Southeast Asia and India rely upon the Himalayas That's melting away also. That means there'll be flooding, but not sustainable release of water throughout the year. They're doing nothing about that. And what about in America's West? They're not doing anything about that either. And what about the Agalaga, the largest aquifer in America? It's over 50% down and contaminated. Well, they're not doing anything about that. So why not? Well, at one point, it's just not sexy. It doesn't have that, you know, everything flashes around it. It's not a headliner. When you start talking global warming and the science of it, people's eyes glaze over. They want something that's more fascinating to them, like some form of terrorist attack, and then the perceived threat that we have from that. So our money and resources go in the wrong direction. And hence, we just keep in denial that that day is coming when our environment turns against us. I'm Gary Noll. Now I want you to hear a piece on DDT, two pieces, one from the orthodoxy trying to say DDT, and then a response by Rachel Carson, who was the first real environmentalist in American history. And everything that we can say thank you to today in our consciousness came from her.
Time magazine carried an advertisement claiming DDT was good for people, homes, and farms. It took 20 years before scientists realized how dangerous it was.
It begins with the war-born development of DDT. This diabolical weapon of modern science saved millions of humans, but killed billions of insects. Man, with this newly discovered force, has at long last gained the upper hand in our age-old struggle. Just like these mosquito larvae, it came from laboratories where top scientists from famous universities and from industrial and government organizations collaborated to develop something new and different. They succeeded. They perfected Pestroy, the most effective weapon man has ever wielded against insects. To begin with, this new pest killer is a DDT preparation. We realize what that means. Once a bug comes in contact with DDT, he's lost. All he has to do is just walk on any Pestroy-treated surface. DDT is absorbed through the feet and spreads throughout the insect's entire nervous system. The effect is disastrous. DDT seems to literally drive bugs crazy. But not for long. DDT next paralyzes, then kills. In both its forms, powder and liquid, Pestroy means doomsday to us insects. For this new insect destroyer contains a lot of DDT, not just a little. Its DDT content is even higher than government specifications. But the really sure kill feature of this insect killer isn't simply that it contains DDT, it's the way that it makes sure that bugs get the DDT that's in it. The same deadly effectiveness of the liquid form is found in the Pestroy powder. It is so easy to apply because of a new efficient dispenser package. All people have to do is to press the patented top like this. It's a handful of concentrated death. This powder is truly activated. It contains stabilized pyrethrum, an ingredient which literally stampedes insects from their hiding places to bring them into contact with DDT, indoors or outdoors. Stirs them up, drives them out of cracks and crevices.
With the possibility of a serious infantile paralysis epidemic, health authorities of the city of San Antonio, Texas, attacked the germ carriers throughout the city. With the war discovered DDT in special sprayers, sections of the city are blanketed with the insecticide in the fight to stop the spread of the dread poliomyelitis. Every suspected spot is sprayed. Even the streams are disinfected, and in the parks and public places, children are forbidden to gather. Rounds of DDT are used in this fight against the dread disease, whose principal target is the young. Again, war has contributed one of its discoveries to save life.
From 1945 to 1955, annual pesticide use on farms went from 125 million pounds to over 600 million. Soon, government agencies began treating even the suburbs with DDT.
People thought it was a good thing because they got action in solving a problem as they conceived it. They were, for example, complaining about mosquitoes. And if the spray truck came down the street, they were told to just stay indoors for a few minutes and everything would be all right. So you had the government endorsing a product and you had the chemical industry pushing it very aggressively.
There was a development program going on within the corporate system saying, well, a little bit is good, but a lot more is much better, isn't it?
Public health departments staged demonstrations to convince the public of DDT's effectiveness and safety. Enthusiasm for the chemical knew no bounds, and few were questioning the wisdom of such use. Public places and private backyards were being treated whether people liked it or not. In 1957, planes sprayed a Massachusetts bird sanctuary owned by Olga Huckins, a friend of Carson's. In fury and desperation, Huckins told her what had happened. The birds showed all the symptoms typical of DDT poisoning. Huckins knew that the planes would be back in spite of her protests. She asked Carson for help. Carson later remembered how the thought of a spring silent of birdsong had moved her to action.
It was your personal letter to me that started it all. In it, you told what had happened and begged me to find someone in Washington who could help. It was in the course of finding that someone that I realized I must write the book.
We have to remember that children born today are exposed to these chemicals from birth, perhaps even before birth. Now, what is going to happen to them in adult life as a result of that exposure? We simply don't know.
This is one of the nation's bestsellers, first printed on September 27, 1962.
In her groundbreaking book, Silent Spring, Rachel Carson jolted a prosperous post-war America, a country confident that science and technology were leading the way to a future in which disease and hunger could be overcome. In no small part, thanks to a new generation of powerful pesticides. But in Silent Spring, Carson warned that progress had a price.
These sprays, dust, and aerosols are now applied almost universally to farms, gardens, forests, and homes. Non-selective chemicals that have the power to kill every insect, the good and the bad, to still the song of birds and the leaping of fish in the streams. All this, though the intended target may be only a few weeds or insects.
Through sheer determination, Carson participated in an hour-long CBS News documentary on pesticides.
CBS reports, The Silent Spring of Rachel Carson.
Which aired not long after Silent Spring became a national bestseller.
Can anyone believe it is possible to lay down such a barrage of poisons on the surface of the earth without making it unfit for all life?
While Carson didn't contend that chemical insecticides must never be used, she faced harsh opposition.
A spokesman for the chemical industry, Dr. Robert White Stevens.
The major claims in Miss Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, are gross distortions of the actual facts, completely unsupported by scientific experimental evidence and general practical experience in the field. If man were to faithfully follow the teachings of Miss Carson, we would return to the Dark Ages, and the insects and diseases and vermin would once again inherit the earth.
And when CBS turned to government experts, the questions were many, but the answers few.
Dr. Paige Nicholson, water pollution expert, Public Health Service.
Do you know how long the pesticides persist in the water once they get into it?
Not entirely.
Do you know the extent to which our groundwater may be contaminated right now by pesticides?
We don't know that either, nor do we know if concentration may be occurring in groundwater.
There appears to be growing concern among scientists as to the possibility of dangerous long-range side effects from the widespread use of DDT and other pesticides. Have you considered asking the Department of Agriculture or the Public Health Service to take a closer look at this?
Yes, I know that they already are. I think particularly, of course, since Ms. Carson's book, but they are.
Ms. Carson maintains that the balance of nature is a major force in the survival of man, whereas the modern chemist, the modern biologist, the modern scientist believes that man is steadily controlling nature.
Now, to these people, apparently the balance of nature was something that was repealed as soon as man came on the scene. Well, you might just as well assume that you could repeal the law of gravity. The balance of nature is built of a series of interrelationships between living things and between living things and their environment. You can't just step in with some brute force and change one thing without changing a good many others. Now, this doesn't mean, of course, that we must never interfere, that we must not attempt to tilt that balance of nature in our favor. But unless we do bring these chemicals under better control, we are certainly headed for disaster.
Rachel Carson, author of the landmark book Silent Spring, started a revolution. During the 1950s, when crop dusting planes and insect sprays blanketed plants with DDT, Carson warned of the dangers of chemical pesticides. She warned of science's power to alter nature and called for government action to protect its citizens. Because of her courage, the disaster did not come to pass, and with Carson's words and spirit, the modern environmental movement was born.
Okay, there you have some very rare clips. If you've never heard Rachel Carson, you have a chance, and you can actually go to my website and see the video clip as well. And we want to thank the million people a day who are going there or thereabouts to download this information. Now I want to talk about an article from Yes Magazine, a really good magazine on the environment I have a lot of respect for, from Ken Eckhart. Quote, against the backdrop of lush green mountains and swaying papaya trees, Loon readies his crop of carrots, kale, and eggplant for the weekly farmer's market. He carefully tends his one-third acre in Hawaii, preparing produce for market stall he shares with friends, young farmers like himself, a few of whom he met when they worked neighboring plots on this land owned by the University of Hawaii. At 32, Lun has an office job with a career in restaurant kitchens behind him. He hopes to own a farm of his own, to be a part of the local food movement, and to help transform the industrial food system. But taking that on now is a substantial investment, so Lun is starting out here in an agricultural incubator program called Go Farm Hawaii, where he can share resources, learn from experts, and perhaps, more importantly, join a community. All right, then it goes on to talk about it, and it's a good piece. But what it's saying is there are no young farmers. In fact, when you look at the statistics, there are not enough young farmers to come close to replacing the older farmers. 6% are under 35. And we've got 2.1 million farms, and 62% are people who are 55 and older, and that's not good. We need more. But look at why we don't have more younger farmers. It takes a lot of money. The average value of land and buildings on not a big farm, just a normal farm, is $1,075,000. And most of them lose money, and for a lot of good reasons they lose money. Then today there's this article from Washington State University, and it says there's an analysis of 40 years of science, and it says organic agriculture is the key to feeding the world sustainably. And so now you got two things simultaneously. You've got a major study saying we can only feed the world if we do it organically. And then we have not enough young people are going into farming, and a lot of old people are retiring, selling their farms. And so we have a shrinking of farms. And then on top of all that, we have a crisis in agriculture. That crisis is rain, snow, hot, dry, drought, insects, pesticides, GMOs, all of this, and it's a mess. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.